And we're back. We're gone for a minute, but now we're back with the jump off. I think I heard that in a poem once. Welcome, Mike, and Oscar. Another week. We hope you enjoyed your Thanksgiving holiday, spent some time with your family, got loaded up on tryptophan and stuffing, passed out watching football, and we hope the political talk was kept at a minimum for you to enjoy the surroundings with at your holiday. This week, we're digging not too far back in the past, kind of a more recent episode for you guys with one of our retrospective episodes. It is the 2012 Best Supporting Actor race. By my memory, I think it's our first time we're delving into the supporting category, and we're going to start with the Best Supporting Actors of 2012. The reason we picked this one, there are huge names in this category. I mean, you know, if you saw the post on social media, again, we're Mike, and Oscar on Facebook, Mike, and Oscar on Instagram, MMO_pod on Twitter. You can reach us at MikeMikeAndOscar@gmail.com. We posted all over there. This field lacked diversity, but what it lacked in diversity, it made up for in just massive Hollywood royalty being a part of this category. Philip Seymour Hoffman for The Master, Tommy Lee Jones in Lincoln. You have Alan Arkin for his work in Argo, the man that won the category, Christoph Waltz for his work in Django Unchained. And then last and never ever least in talking about acting categories, Robert De Niro putting on a monumental performance, big comeback performance for him as the father of Bradley Cooper in Silver Linings Playbook. So those are the five big names we're going into in this episode. We're going to talk about some of the performances. We think one guy maybe shouldn't have been nominated. Maybe someone else outshined him in his own movie. Going to get into all that and more on this episode. This one is going to feature our annual year in review. We're going to talk about 2012, the economical and political backdrop against which all these movies were seen. Then we're going to get into our first three nominees. We're going to give you the profile and backstory on Philip Seymour Hoffman for his work in The Master, Alan Arkin for his work in Argo, and Tommy Lee Jones playing Thaddeus Stevens in the Daniel Day-Lewis award-winning picture, Lincoln. So, back at it. Another manic Monday. Sit back, relax, maybe kill a few hours for you at work here. This is episode one of the 2012 Best Supporting Actor race. Episode two will be coming out later this week, where we're going to finish off the category and fill you in with Christoph Waltz, Robert De Niro, and our Perfecting Perfection category. But until then, take it all in. Episode one, 2012, coming at you right now. So we're going to start off here, the 2012 Best Supporting Actor race, as Mike is in rare form today. Would you like to introduce myself?
Introduce no, absolutely not. No. I'm sorry. I'm also Mike, yeah.
Well, I mean, we have that part already. But it's fine. As we always do, we're going to start with the year in review, see what the backdrop, the cultural, political climate was at the time of 2012, which was only 5 years ago, if you remember, because this is 2017, oddly enough.
Wow.
Yeah, believe that. 5 years ago, though. That sucks.
This seems like last year.
Getting too old. But these are all the backdrop against which these movies were found. And surprisingly, for this year, I don't have that much horrific stuff.
Yeah, so. No, I'm still caught on the last point. I mean, I still wear most of the same t-shirts. I still have the exact same haircut. I didn't go with the trendy beard thing
yet. Think every man gets to a point where time just stops for them. Like, this is it. This is my look. This is what I'm doing with my life.
This is what I got, folks.
Yeah, this is the mountaintop, or at least where I'm willing to stop on the mountain.
But I would never have ordered an iced cinnamon almond milk macchiato back in 2012.
Who says people can't change?
No. You complete me.
Opening doors. 2012 year in review. We'll go right to February 2012. Queen Elizabeth II celebrated her 60th anniversary of her ascension to the throne of England. Poor Charles. Still just waiting in the wings. Greece in February as well was granted its second huge bailout, this time to the tune of 130 billion with a B euros.
Yikes.
Yeah, you all remember that happening. March of the same year, the Encyclopedia Britannica halts its print edition after nearly 250 years of those books in print. I think my grandmother's
Wikipedia.
Yeah. I think my grandmother owned every edition ever.
Yeah, I mean, donate to Wikipedia, folks.
We need to make money off this, it needs to go directly.
Shamelessly, we have not.
In April, I'm going to get this word completely wrong, but Kwang Myung Song.
No, you're not right. Thanks. Let me check my notes.
Thanks, man. A North Korean surveillance satellite blows up shortly after launch. Who would have thought the things that North Korea fires off don't work? But
why do I remember none of this?
Because reality is so much more terrible now than what we thought was a big deal then. July had the Summer Olympic Games that were held in London. Big stories were Michael Phelps becoming the most decorated Olympian of all time, winning his 22nd medal. Usain Bolt being the fastest man in the world.
Yep. Tall and awesome.
Yeah, the strides like nobody's business. You know, like he runs like a 9 second 100 meter dash, and I have to take like a 2 day 100 meter dash.
9 seconds. It's legitimately 9 seconds. I mean, his start is absurd. I tried to teach the kids those things, and just could teach none of them.
July. I'm sorry. Also, we had the worst blackout in history of the world, as 620 million people in India were left without power over a 2 day span.
Mm-hmm.
So just remember that next time your AC shits the bed in the middle of summer. February of 2013, we'll go right after summer, North Korea completed its third underground nuclear test on the way to full nuclear capability, something we're still seeing the effect of today in the news. By the time this episode comes out, we may be in full-blown war, so who knows?
Oh, my God.
A human ear is grown in a lab via a 3D printer, providing the first roadmap to a whole new world of medical marvels in terms of transplants. And the last note I have before this Oscars ceremony kicked off was Benedict XV became the first pope to resign while still alive. Since the year 1415.
Wow.
Eh, doesn't happen, I guess. That papal position is pretty much in stone until you're dead.
Most of this stuff is just stuff I was not aware of.
This is a learning experience. This is what we do. We try to open the minds of our viewers.
I remember.
And then bitch at each other over a rom-com.
I remember every one of these movies like the back of my hand. And yet...
We are not the two men with the priorities.
We have three popes and like... 4 years. I don't remember.
Like, goddamn, 12 years a slave. So we're talking about the 2012 Academy Awards. The show was hosted February 24th, 2013 in the Dolby Theater in Hollywood. Very marked performance by Seth MacFarlane as the host. He was derided and criticized all over. People thought he was too hammy, too sarcastic. I happen to like him. Do you remember him hosting?
You basically have the same voice.
I don't know about that.
So, I mean, if Kelsey Grammer's and Seth MacFarlane's voice could mate, it would be Tommy Lee Jones, which is another character we're going to talk about.
Right. Lincoln, the film Tommy Lee Jones was nominated for, had the most nominations on the night with 12. Life of Pi took home the most golden statues with 4. The five candidates for Best Supporting Actor in 2012, we had Philip Seymour Hoffman working on his 4th nomination, his first since Doubt in 2009. He was nominated for The Master, Alan Arkin. Also his 4th nomination, his first since 2007's Little Miss Sunshine for his work in Argo. Tommy Lee Jones has, again, his 4th nomination, his first since 2008's In the Valley of Elah for his work in Lincoln. Robert De Niro, his 7th nomination at the time, first since 1992, however, working with Scorsese in Cape Fear for his work in Silver Linings Playbook. And finally, the man that won the category and the trophy on the night, Christoph Waltz, having a 2nd nomination, his first since Inglourious Basterds 3 years prior, where he also won the Best Supporting Actor Oscar.
Yes, he did.
For his work in Django Unchained. We will start with the great Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Lancaster Dodd in The Master. What do we have on him, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, PSH was born in Fairport, New York in 1967. His mother was an elementary school teacher who became a lawyer and then eventually a family court judge. His dad was a career with the Xerox Corporation, a career executive. He had a brother and 2 sisters. He loved baseball and wrestling as a kid, so he was an athlete as a young kid. He saw a stage production of Arthur Hiller's All My Sons at age 12. In quotes, "I was changed, permanently changed by that experience. It was a miracle to me." Apparently, he was still distracted by that experience on the ball field. He had a serious neck injury a year later. Whoops.
He was taking in the aesthetics.
And he couldn't play sports anymore. He basically is going to theater camp every summer after that. His first theater camp in high school, the New York State Summer School of the Arts in Saratoga, he meets future collaborators Bennett Miller and Dan Futterman, who wind up writing and directing Capote and a bunch of other movies.
One of your favorites.
As a tandem. Yeah, I mean, literally the best going to sleep movie of all time. I mean, it's put me out like a light.
I don't know how you sleep to that voice.
No, there's no reason to take sleeping pills. I just put on Capote.
But you think someone's under your bed with that
voice. And I'm done. Yeah, it's perfect.
Can you get me a glass of water?
Hoffman applies to a bunch of acting programs after high school. He's accepted to the Tisch School at NYU. There he founds an acting troupe, supports himself as an usher in the theaters in the area, many of which are there because it's NYC. And he graduates in 1989. He makes his TV debut in 91 as a man accused of rape in an episode of Law and Order.
Don't they all? Don't yeah, they all?
So that old chestnut. I mean, I've literally walked in on my grandfather, rest his soul, and my grandmother multiple times to the filthiest of plot lines on Law and Order. And it's always Law and Order.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the criminal justice system, there are two people that are equal.
Was there semen on his teeth? Did the bone fragments have blood in your... It's a good, grotesque, horrible. Anyway.
And that's why they stayed together.
He makes a bunch of indie films. 1993, he's a spoiled yuppie student as his first breakout movie, In Scent of a Woman.
Hoo-ah!
Yeah. So, I mean, a bunch of indie films, Scent of a Woman, Steel Scenes in Paul Thomas Anderson's debut film, Hard Eight, 1996's Twister, PTA's Boogie Nights in 97, where he played a boom operator who attempts to seduce Dirk Diggler, the male porn star played by Mark Wahlberg. So
one of the classic skin-crawlingly male-on-male kissing scenes of all time.
Pretty much walking the typical path.
Yeah, we've all been there.
Stardom. Hoffman kept his scene-stealing ways in 1998's The Big Lebowski with his role as Brandt. Many a facial expression that we loved in that
fantastic
movie.
Fantastic cameo.
He probably had his first real breakout role, if you couldn't say it was Boogie Nights. It definitely was Magnolia, where he played
so
the hospice worker.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson and him have teamed up quite a bit. Plays the hospice worker who his dying patient tries to get him to track down his estranged son, who happens to be Tom Cruise, who seizure cries in front of people. Philip Seymour Hoffman for about like a 4-minute scene.
He always finds himself in these.
Which must have took 45 takes.
Yeah, like, ugh.
And that's what started his drug habit. I was like, this is like the hardest guy to make jokes for ever. He's fucking dead.
He's the greatest actor of all time.
He's the greatest actor of all time. I can't make fun of him. He's in every one of my favorite movies. So yeah, you're going to get horrifying jokes here. And I'm sticking with it. That's evil. I'm sorry. Anyway, Hoffman acted in some awesome movies over the next 5 years after Magnolia's 1999's Magnolia. The Talented Mr. Ripley, give or take it or leave it. Almost Famous, Punch Drunk Love, Red Dragon, Cold Mountain, and a surprise comic turn in Along Came Polly.
Skittles!
Which is kind of funny. It's funny once. It's really funny once.
His part in it. I mean, he plays it. That's the thing about it. Any part he has, plays to a T. It's unbelievable. He's great. Yeah. I love him.
So he and his old friends from summer camp meet up in 2005. Bennett Miller and Dan Futterman, they cast him in the role of Capote, where he sweeps award season, culminating in a Best Actor Oscar. Obviously, as I said, this is the greatest going to sleep movie of all time, because just the credit scenes alone will put you out. But it's also a pretty terrific movie in its own right, so watch it during the day as well. 25th Hour, Charlie Wilson's War, Doubt, The Ides of March, Moneyball, and his lead role in A Most Wanted Man are some more of my PSH favorites. The Master was Philip Seymour Hoffman's fourth Oscar nomination. He also was nominated for 4 Golden Globes over that time. He's won one of each for Capote. He was also nominated for an Emmy for the miniseries Empire Falls, which is a pretty good book and miniseries on HBO, and 5 BAFTA nominations with a win again for Capote. Tragically, Hoffman died of a cocaine and heroin cocktail overdose. Could not be more sad. And now we're about to try to walk on eggshells while we try not to make jokes about Scientology because we both saw those documentaries.
Yeah, Going Clear, if you've seen it on HBO.
What a great documentary.
It's a fantastic documentary.
Terrified to be a squirrel. Yeah. I'm not a squirrel. I am not a squirrel.
We'll have to cancel Tom Cruise being on this pod at any point soon, I think. Philip Seymour Hoffman getting an Oscar nominee for his role as Lancaster Dodd in this film with the master. Debuted September 1st, 2012 at the Venice Film Festival and came
L.
wide.
Ron Ubberhey.
It debuted wide 2 weeks later on September 14th. Written and directed by PTA, Paul Thomas Anderson. The film itself had 3 Oscar nominations, but 0 wins. Nominated for Best Supporting Actress with A.B. Adams. Best Lead Actor, Joaquin Phoenix. And Best Supporting Actor, Philip Seymour Hoffman. A 7.1 composite rating on IMDb. It was a relative box office flop, as it failed to make back even its listed budget of $32 million, but still widely critically revered as a movie about the origins of Scientology and the life of founder L. Ron Hubbard without directly claiming to be that. In a 2016 poll of 177 professional film critics, The Master finished as the 24th greatest film of the 21st century.
Wow.
So we're in the top 25 ballpark here.
Critical darling. And I can see why.
Yeah, it's definitely got its hallmarks. I have my issues with it, but it's a solid watch. The Master is centered around the main character is a man named Freddy Quell, who's played by Joaquin Phoenix. As I said, he's a clearly odd, sexually frustrated soldier. Must have been a total stretch for Phoenix to play.
Yeah, I mean, he's like the target audience, the target, everybody's target cult person.
Yeah, I mean,
this has just like follower tattooed across his forehead.
He's a guy that works in the Navy. One of the first scenes we see of him is him finger
sexually infuriating movie.
A woman made out of sand that him and his Navy mates make on a beachside. But anyway, he's this lost soul.
Yet somehow this wasn't a big mainstream success.
Yeah, I don't get it either. he's kind of drifting through life. He has these, nominal jobs. He's a photographer in a department store. He gets into a fist fight with one of the patrons, yada, yada, yada. Eventually ends up on this boat, this yacht, that it turns out is being...
Sea Org.
I'm not saying any of these words. I don't need... what's his name?
I'm looking for David Miscavige.
Yeah, the Miscavige show up at my door. What'd you say? But he ends up on this boat that was owned by Lancaster Dodd, who's throwing this big party. It turns out Lancaster Dodd wants to kind of... takes an immediate liking to Freddie and wants to kind of get into his headspace. The whole movie, from the point of view of the Lancaster Dodd character, is essentially, he's L. Ron Hubbard. He's opening him up. He's this cult leader without being a cult leader. Everyone just sees it as a religion and as a new way of thinking. He proclaims that he can go through the people's past and kind of draw out their pain to separate themselves from their pain.
You know, it's an amazing character because Paul Thomas Anderson... I don't want to say this because I want to punch myself in the face when I say this, but I have no other way in which to say it.
I'll punch
you. Humanizes the character.
Yeah.
I mean, in many ways, he makes you like the L. Ron Hubbard persona. And in a very real way, they adopt Freddie Quill, Joaquin Phoenix's freak, stowaway character. They adopt him as like this stray at his daughter's wedding on the Sea Org where they've docked for a few days to throw the wedding party. They adopt Joaquin Phoenix. He kind of sucks him in to some processing, aka schmoditing.
You come up with that yourself?
Yeah. That's it. My brain stopped working.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, he's like this stray dog. Freddie plays the part of this stray dog that Lancaster Dodd and his wife Peggy Dodd, who's played by Amy Adams, they're trying to mold to be basically another good soldier.
And as we know, like the opening, basically the greeting of Scientologists across the world, they have some very solid Freudian principles for their introductory kind of processing, auditing.
Yeah, a lot of their concepts are make sense,
so
right?
A lot of those psychological spots, psychological, whatever you want to call them, rituals or drills or, sessions, they work.
Right.
In a very strict psychological sense. And they help Freddie. And Freddie, of course, in turn helps Lancaster Dodd with his concoctions. He basically makes drinks the stiffest variety.
It's just like
possible.
Turpentine. He's just like handing
him. He puts household items in there. Yeah, I mean, he quite the scene when he has to flee in early going. He has to flee the farm where he's like a sharecropper or whatever. I don't know the you know merchant. What do they call those things that we learned in history class back in 1997, Mike?
I have no idea what you're going. A farmhand?
Not sharecropper, but...
A farmhand?
Indentured servant.
Oh, all right.
He's basically an indentured servant. I think that's right. My history teacher's shaking his head right now. That would be great if I got my history teacher as a audience member, though. Anyway, where was I, Mike?
You have this team full of sophomores and juniors.
I do. They're driving me up a wall right now. Anyway, Freddie Quill is adopted by Lancaster Dodd, and they kind of exchange favors and become friends in a very unhealthy...
Pseudo-lovers.
Unhealthy way.
Touching. Yeah, I mean, yeah. You could tell the whole... There's a lot of sexual tension between Lancaster and Freddie, and it doesn't go unnoticed by Lancaster's wife. But at the same time, Lancaster Dodd, the Philip Seymour Hoffman character, has to stay kind of neutral on it because he knows he has so many people looking up to him. And a lot of his scenes are involved with either directing people to keep their belief in him or having outsiders question what he does and see him unravel quickly.
So I tell you, I mean, to bring it back to the planet Earth here. I mean, he is charismatic. He is welcoming. He cares for Freddie Quill in these opening scenes. And you only, like, have this sinking feeling in the back of your mind because you know who he's supposed to be, that he's somewhat manipulative.
Which, again, if you go back to the Going Clear documentary on HBO, that's exactly right. How they describe David Miscavige, right? He's a very personable, very charismatic, loving guy. But he's also accused of doing all these horrible, awful things. So
yeah, I mean, you love the guy early on. Meeting Philip Seymour Hoffman's character early on, especially after the rough time that Freddie Quill's had. I mean, getting fired from the department store in an epic scene, fighting just somebody who's photographing with kind of a sneak attack of vases from different sides. It's like you're at a Sears in 1950, and they're just having, like, they're throwing vases at one another before he gets fired. Oh, good God. Going from there to his indentured servitude.
Yep.
Which is a vocab word for this week.
Yeah, you're doing great.
And then, yeah, I mean, so you're desperate for him to pick up somewhere, and of course he does. He's like this party yacht.
Yeah, and there's, you know, as Freddie becomes more integrated into the, let's call it just the Lancaster Dodd world, he kind of plays the role of the pit bull for Lancaster Dodd. There's a man that questions Lancaster's teachings at a party. Freddie Quill doesn't like what he's saying. Lancaster tries to keep him at bay. And then in the next scene, we find that Freddie goes to that guy's apartment and beats him up.
My favorite scene. I just thought that on rewatch. I mean, it wasn't my favorite scene years ago. I think I liked the final scene in London quite a bit. But I tell you, on rewatch, when the skeptic is questioning Philip Seymour Hoffman, and like you said, he unravels, and he does it
quickly.
Very quickly.
Very quickly.
And I don't want to give away the punchline of the scene, but dude, he's got it together. And you could see why. You could see why, you know, the cult has evolved over time to no defense, only attack. I mean, Amy Adams literally tells him later on in the movie, he's like, when we're on the defensive, when we try to meet these people in the middle, it doesn't work.
Yeah, she's like the conscience of this movie, but for that movement only, you know?
Yeah, but I tell you, I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson, just to go there, I mean, he could have easily painted them with one brush and just...
Sure, yeah, no, he definitely made them multifaceted, and they're played off beautiful. I mean, how can you not? If you're Philip Seymour Hoffman, you know you're going to get a stark performance, a well-rounded character, which is exactly what you get in Lancaster Dodd.
So yeah, I mean, that was the best scene for me to see... Hoffman, this is right smack in the middle of the movie where kind of Hoffman lets his hair down and does his heel turn, as Mike.
My favorite scene is along those lines. It's not that scene specifically. Mm-hmm. At some point after the middle of the movie, the taxman comes from Lancaster Dodd, you know, he's accusing him of embezzling funds and all that. He gets taken to prison. Freddie goes as well because he ends up attacking a police officer. Mm-hmm. They end up having cells next to one another, and that's when Freddie kind of says, "You're full of shit." Like, you know, he's this mentally. He's not a mentally challenged guy, even though, he may be, but he's not an intelligent man.
The trailer scene you know, a few minutes before, and this is a big trailer line, so I'm not spoiling anything, was the son saying, you know, he's making this up as he goes along.
It's exactly it.
Perfect
right.
setup for what you're
right.
saying.
Right, and Freddie, that kind of clicks in Freddie. He accuses Philip Seymour Hoffman and Lancaster Dodd of being full of shit. And Lancaster Dodd, I mean, he loses it on him and then says, you know, who are you? Who are you to question me? Kind of buys into his own bullshit, but you could also see that this man knows that he's being called out because Freddie's right. Yeah. He's got no substance to anything.
It's amazing.
There's that scene. There's the scene where Laura Dern does the same thing as the outsider. Laura Dern plays a follower and accuses him of...
She plays the best weirdos in the history of...
I love Laura. If you don't like Laura Dern, don't listen to this podcast. I love Laura Dern.
She's awesome.
But she does the same thing. It's another one of my favorite scenes where she kind of, you know, Lancaster releases a new book. She reads it and says, wait a minute. I thought you said you literally went through the past of these people. And in your book, you're saying right. you imagine you go through the past. And Philip Seymour Hoffman can take that criticism for literally one line of debate. Because the second line of debate, he snaps.
Snaps.
On a follower. On someone that's bought into his bullshit.
And you thought his face couldn't get any redder.
Like Tom Coughlin in Green Bay.
So, yeah, a lot of weird scenes mixed in with some super high drama. I mean, this is like religious text for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's an odd movie.
To dramatize that, yeah... To dramatize something so, you know, important.
No, it's definitely a weird movie. And I wish there was stuff for us to disagree on. But it's so in your face, I mean, as far as the conflict and what's at stake for Freddie, especially.
Let's just put it this way. When Freddie Quill watches Philip Seymour Hoffman sing a song by the piano the party. And then imagines every woman in there naked. And
I just
and you
thought,
have the whole scene.
Like... Imagine the actresses in that scene when Paul Thomas Anderson's like, look, we need you to dance around like everything's fine. You're going to be naked.
Of any
age. Just totally nude in the buff.
Oh, by the way, you're naked.
Yeah. Action! So, yeah, I mean, that's, we're not, again, when we do the actor pods, actresses pods, if they're not a screenplay or a best picture pod, we're going to do our best to be spoiler free. So we're going to stop the plot there. We don't want to go on to tell you what happens with the Freddy character and Lancaster and all that. However, I guess in cleaning up this movie, did you have a worse scene since you gave us your best?
Well, I mean, just the weirdness of some scenes really threw me for a loop. That's what I wrote down. Freddie at Sears losing his job after that photo shoot, that was just so brutally awkward. Like, for me, there's no terrible scene in this movie.
No,
awkward o-meter is just raised to 15.
Yeah, your skin jumps off your body at certain points.
10 different points of the movie. Yeah, it's like every climax is just cringeworthy scenes. So yeah. that's what I had. How about you?
No, I'm the same. I usually mark my worst scenes in red, and I don't have anything in my notes. I can't. It's tough. I mean, you're absolutely right. There's some scenes that are just skin-crawlingly awkward.
Yeah.
I can't say any one scene. Maybe it's because of a lack of understanding, but I can't say if any one scene is, you know, so out of context, because the whole movie's out of context.
So, yeah, I mean, I just remember something that stood out. Good God. Anyway, but the Frost Nixon line, the movie that we both love, movie that I watched this week, couldn't help myself. Frost Nixon line of when he's talking about Nixon, you're dealing with a major operator here. Don't forget that. You know, that's the way I felt watching Philip Seymour Hoffman move around the cast here.
Yeah.
I mean, because you know what you're dealing with if you know any of the history at all. And it's scary, but also, you know, beard strokingly intriguing.
Yes.
Yes.
Would you give it a watch?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I mean, if you're obsessed with cults and Scientology in particular and all that.
Yeah, don't smoke up before seeing this.
If you like boobies, weird ones.
Your paranoia will get the best of you for sure.
If you like weird boobies, this is like top five.
That should be the tagline of this podcast. Going to bring us next chronologically to Alan Arkin, the second nominee, playing Lester Siegel in the film Argo. What do we have in the career of the man Alan Arkin?
Alan Arkin was born in Brooklyn in 1934. Shocker right there. His mom was a school teacher and his dad was a painter and a writer. His grandparents were Jewish immigrants from Russia and Germany, but Arkin did not grow up religious. In fact, during the Red Scare, Arkin's parents were accused of being communists. And his father was fired from his job when he refused to answer questions, vindicated only after his death. So that's just kind of like an interesting...
I can't even imagine being under that kind of pressure, you know? Like, you a commie? No. Oh, yeah, you are. No.
Well, I was a Bernie bro.
Yeah, that's the same thing. That's a good parallel to draw. None of our listeners will have problems with that.
Arkin began acting lessons at age 10, attended several elite New York acting schools throughout his childhood and adolescence on scholarship before going off to Los Angeles City College in 1951. There he becomes a musician and the lead singer of the folk group The Terriers, who would score a number 4 hit on the Billboard 100 with the Banana Boat song.
What?
A year out of college. Yes, this is true. Essentially, this is 4 white boys taking a Jamaican folk song, meshing it with another Jamaican folk song, and it becomes a nationwide hit.
So unless you thought cultural appropriation was just the hashtag for 2017, Alan Arkin was doing it before your parents were around.
But look, I'm sure it's the only time this has ever happened again or since. Yeah. Anyway, a shocking development, Alan Arkin's music career did not stay hot, though. The Terriers break up, and he winds up...
Where's the behind the music on that one?
He winds up singing with a children's folk group called the Babysitters.
The Manson Family.
This group basically pays the bills for him throughout his, you know, post-college years, all the way up till 1968. However, in 1960... Arkin is kind of brought back into acting. The music career is not going anywhere. He's singing Blue's Clues, you know, on the weekends, making money with that. But he's also in operas.
We just got a letter. We just got a letter.
Daylight come in, me wanna go home. That's the Banana Smoke song, folks. He's singing operas, though, with Madeline freaking Kahn, one of the funniest people to ever live. In the 1960s, she kind of gets him involved with a comedy troupe that you might have heard before called Second City. He was one of the founding members of Second City. He wrote and directed and acted in short films throughout the 60s. And then he breaks through in television and film as an actor in the mid-60s. One of his first movies, Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, in 1966, he is nominated for a Best Actor Oscar. Sorry. Best lead, I think. Maybe it was best supporting. I didn't. So yeah, I mean, 15 minutes of fame as a top,
singer.
musical artist. He's a pop star. Then he's singing Blue's Clues. Then he's cracking wise with Madeline Kahn in the back of the theater, and also going up there and singing.
Same story in Hollywood over and over.
Improv, guerrilla filmmaking, Oscars.
Yeah.
So all in 10 years. So this was if. You know,
not a bad decade.
And Mike didn't believe Forrest Gump was believable. You're a cynical man, Michael. Anyway, Arkin's filmography is massive and impressive in equal measure. 1968 nets him his second Best Actor nomination for The Heart is a Hunter. He'd be nominated twice more in the Best Supporting category, of course, for Argo, but also winning it for Little Miss Sunshine. Some more of my favorite Alan Arkin movies are Catch-22, The In-Laws, Glengarry Glen Ross, Edward Scissorhands, Gross Point Blank, and if you haven't seen it, you should, Slums of Beverly Hills. He's currently acting in the production of a live-action Dumbo movie, which will be released in 2019.
Which is an awful idea. Cancel Disney. 66, 68.
Therefore, cancel everybody.
Yeah, they probably just canceled this podcast. 66, 68 were his nominees, and then not again until 07, right. And then again in 2012. That's pretty amazing. Yeah, just kind of sleep at the wheel for 40 years.
He basically turns into everybody's fantasy grandpa, I think.
Yeah,
so,
that's
you know,
what he is. Yeah.
Everybody's fantasy neighbor, old man neighbor. Fantasy grandpa.
Or grumpy Hollywood producer, as is his case.
General fantasy man. No, but I mean,
say the butt on that. Alan Arkin nominated for his role as Lester Siegel in Argo. The film debuted August 31st, 2012 at the Telluride Film Festival, and then had a wide release in October 12th of the same year. Directed by Ben Affleck, as we all know. Written by Chris Terrio, based on the book written by Tony Mendez, who's the character Affleck plays in the movie.
Right.
And also based on a magazine article written by Joshua Bierman. The movie had 7 Oscar nominees, took home 3 Golden Statues on the night. Categories it did not win was sound editing, sound mixing, best music original score, best supporting actor for Alan Arkin, of course. The ones that it did take home were film editing, best adapted screenplay, and best picture. As Ben Affleck kind of got his glory moment to beam and gloat, taking home the best picture nominee, because Affleck was not, he won the Golden Globe for best director, but was not even nominated for best director at the Oscars, which is a very rare occurrence.
Crazy.
A 7.7 IMDb rating made it into 25 different major top 10 lists for best movies of the year for 2012, according to a bunch of critics polled for the various outlets. So we have Argo. Usually, when it comes to these films, I'm the one that kind of gives you a quick breakdown. I want to go quickly through the plot so Mike and I can bicker and bitch at one another, and that's where the money's made in this podcast. Mike is going to take the helm at this one because he has a perfect explanation for what the movie Argo is. Take it away.
I mean, this movie essentially is this. You have the embassy stormed by a mob, which is obviously the most action-packed beginning of a lot of movies. So you do have that. But for your protagonist, Ben Affleck, he goes to a couple meetings, talks to some movie people, sets up a table read for a movie. The people who are need to be rescued after they escape from a stormed embassy, they go basically hang out at the ambassador's mansion.
Canadian ambassador.
So Canadian ambassador. So they, you get the folks who need to be rescued go hang out at a mansion where they seem to be having fun.
Right. Well, they can't go outside, but
Ben Affleck gets there. They this is spoiler filled, by the way. But Ben Affleck gets there, and they go out around town, take a tour of the city, walk around. That's it. And then they, you know, they party that night.
Sure
they go through airport security the next day. That's the movie.
Argo.
Argo, fuck yourself. Yeah. I mean, this movie, nothing happens. Nothing happens, and yet it's like one of the most suspenseful movies in 25 years.
Definitely worthy of the best picture.
So, I mean, Ben Affleck directed the shit out of this movie.
Yeah, I mean, and that's true. I mean, what Mike said is exactly what happens. Beat by beat, those are the major scenes in the movies.
So, yeah, I mean, if I spoiled it for you.
It's a historical event.
Listen, it's number one, it's a historical event, but you know what, you should know what happens, and if you don't, it's still going to be the most suspenseful freaking movie ever because he just does his
It's great a great, job. Great. I mean, it's on the. You know, listen. Nobody wants me and Mike to disagree more than me and Mike because we don't like slobbing each other.
Like,
you know,
one another.
Yeah, we aren't friends. But we, you know, we know it conflict creates, you know, more. Whatever. We know conflict creates better listening sometimes, but you can't in a movie like this, in one like The Master, where it's so punch you in the face and it's so obvious the genius behind both the Philip Seymour Hoffman role, the Argo script as a whole. I mean, there's just
they're
things that are
obviously
there.
Good movies.
Yeah,
I mean, they're obviously good movies. Yeah, it's hard to.
Can you nitpick? Can you say certain things were wrong about it? Of course, you can do that for anything. But was Argo worthy of being nominated for a Best Picture? I think without a question.
Without a question.
It was such a boring premise that was, like you said, edge of your seat. What's going to happen next? Your heart's racing. The
more
time.
I watch this movie, the higher I rank it. I just can't help myself. I mean, you have to recognize the capability being showcased here. Here's the big question I have for you, though. Who's better, Bryan Cranston or Alan Arkin?
This
I mean,
is, Cranston you didn't bring it up.
Is like half of his face is red, half, and he's like crying and just like getting so flustered. Most of the movie, it's either he's overacting or he's going for broke.
And I think,
and Alan Arkin's like, yeah, or go fuck yourself. He has all the punchlines.
I know Warren Beatty. that to me is the whole crux of the argument here. It's okay. Alan Arkin is a Hollywood movie producer who they need to get the Argo script greenlighted, get the rights to it so they can pretend that it's actually a movie that's going to be happening. They need to film locations. So they need Alan Arkin's characters back, Lester Siegel's back.
Right.
That's fine. The movie from his point of view is basically just
take a couple meetings.
Yeah.
Throw a fake party.
There's nothing on the line for him.
And then sit in an office.
Answer a phone call.
Riveting.
That
riveting.
Doesn't even answer.
Riveting.
That John Goodman answers.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's nothing on the line for him. Bryan Cranston, on the other hand, like you said, yeah, he's overacting, but that's because he's got fucking people's lives in his hands. He plays an agent for the CIA.
He's running across an office.
He needs to tell Tony
Get
Mendes.
Me the president on the phone. I am the one who knocks.
He needs to green light this plan in the first place. Then he needs to tell Tony Mendez, who's over in you know, saving these guys, telling him that the plan's off. Yep. Then he needs to go back to the president's office, telling him Tony Mendez is going through with the fucking plan in the first place. I mean, of course he's going to be overacting. I think if you didn't bring it up, I was going to, because to me, that's the whole argument in this movie. The best supporting actor nominee from this movie should have gone to Cranston, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, Alan Arkin has all the punchlines.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and we're going to say this about Tommy Lee Jones, too. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the Scene Stealer Award.
Right.
This is the Best Supporting Actor Oscar is the Scene Stealer's Award.
Exactly.
Because the snarky old man probably should not get nominated for this. I love Alan Arkin.
How can
I love
you not?
Many
How
of his movies.
Not? Right. I mean, Alan Arkin, he's a fantastic actor. He hits the sarcasm greatly. But
I mean, the one scene, when you talk about Oscar, we try to, you know, identify Oscar real scenes in our notes. And, the one scene where I could say, like, all right, he's emoting all this conflicting information. He's really, you could see the inner turmoil going on is the deal he makes to buy the script, where he's essentially, you know, his plan going in to lowball the shit out of this guy. And
which he plays, which is hilarious.
Which is funny.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny scene. He needs to buy the rights for the Argo script from a studio that's not going to use it, that's just sitting on it. They basically threaten him, tell him his character's career is basically over.
Right.
And he responds with this bullshit story about knowing Warren Beatty, knowing that Ned Beatty's going to leave that studio to do something else on TV, and it works, and they get the script. Fantastic. Hilarious scene. His quips to this movie executive are funny. You know, you're laughing through it. But that's his Oscar scene.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, like, it's him sitting in an office bullshitting about a script. There's nothing on the line for this character through the whole movie. Except
I don't think his facial expression really changes the whole movie. He's just got that smirk on his face.
That's a great point.
I mean, I know Hollywood loves to nominate the characters who kind of, you know,
play Hollywood.
But play Hollywood. But they also don't necessarily, the quiet performance. You know, this is the quiet performance.
Yeah, but it's a quiet performance because he's not in the movie. He's not integral to the plot.
Yeah, it really doesn't make sense.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, Argo, I think we both say, is a watch, for sure. I mean, it's a great, tense movie. Is Alan Arkin, you know, is he worthy of this nomination? I don't think so. Certainly not when Bryan Cranston is acting the shit out of his role 10 times over compared to what Arkin's doing in any of his best scenes.
Yeah, I mean, best scenes of the movie for me, the finale and the opening montage are two of the, you know, most impressive sequences in the movies the last 20 years. I mean, that opening where they storm the embassy, you can know what happens in real history or not. That's crazy.
It is.
And then the end where they basically, you know, do what all of us do a few times a year or more, go through airport security. It was just clenchingly
that
terrifying.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that was my favorite scene too, the airport security scene where the rebels stop the quote unquote film crew from getting on the plane because they need to make a call to the Hollywood studio to see if Tony Mendez is fake name is actually a Hollywood executive,
right?
And a phone's ringing, and it's up to Alan Arkin and John Goodman to answer that call and basically save these people's lives, which they do. Spoiler, I guess.
we spoiled the Argo. Fuck.
We never spoil these movies. Yeah,
consistent.
Least favorite
scene for me was the traditional Dark Night of the Soul. I'm using air quotes. Nobody could see me in this podcast. Remember that, Michael, please. Anyway, the every screenwriting book you ever read as a low point where that you got to hit, whatever you call it. Different gurus have different names for it. But the Dark Night of the Soul scene is literally a dark night where a bearded Ben Affleck stares at a bottle of whiskey.
His air quotes have been going the whole time.
He's either going to drink it or not. I don't bathe regularly.
Why did you put Ben Affleck in quotes? Do you not believe it's Ben Affleck?
I don't have good hygiene.
I may not smell right. Yeah, there's a lot of nitpicking with the Arkin scenes, certainly. I mean, my biggest least favorite scene is that he's nominated because he shouldn't be. And I have that. But, I mean, you know, as a whole, I didn't really have – again, if you're taking – like I said with The Master, it's tough when a movie hits the notes that it wants to so impressively and efficiently like Argo does. It wants to be a suspense thriller, and it is. It's tough for me to nitpick a bad scene.
Yeah,
I couldn't find one.
The Master wants to, you know – hump you in the middle of the night.
Right.
And this movie wants to make you laugh and make you, and be suspenseful and be a movie maker's movie.
Right.
And we love that about it. Mm-hmm. And two very different
and
tastes.
Hollywood got a chance to wax poetic about itself, which it's always going to
see, take. We also save history. George Clooney's just like marching in a room by himself, giving his Oscar speech.
That'll bring us to our third movie, our third nominee. Tommy Lee Jones as Thaddeus Stevens in Lincoln. Tommy Lee Jones, obviously one of the most respected actors in Hollywood. I don't think that the wig was something from the prop department. I think he owns it that he wore in this movie. He just brought it from home. What do we have on Tommy Lee Jones?
I already used my opening joke about your voice mating with another voice equaling Tommy Lee Jones. But essentially, I'm very upset that you don't have a Tommy Lee Jones impression in your repertoire.
I'll work on one. I don't know if it's going to happen
really
in this. Yeah, I got to...
I suck at impressions so bad, and you basically speak low enough to handle it, but...
I was going to say gibberish.
Anyway, Tommy Lee Jones was born in 1946 in San Saba, Texas.
He was only born in 46?
Yes.
Seems like he was born in, like, 20.
46. 46 in San Saba, Texas, and grew up in Midland, attending Robert E. Lee High School. So I'm not going to touch a joke on that with a 10-foot pole. I'm doing the Brandt gesture from...
10-foot tiki torch?
Yeah. Anyway, his mom's a police officer. His dad was an oil field worker. And his grandpa was a Colt 45 pistol. Sorry. Try to write some shtick. Anyway, football, guns, and the Texas heat. Not what you'd think would be the crucible to forge a Harvard thespian.
No.
But indeed, Tommy Lee Freegan Jones goes to Harvard. He majors in English. He rooms with Al Gore. But he also plays guard on the football team, by the way, which he's a part of the epic 1968 game and also the subject of the great documentary Harvard Beats Yale 29-29. Every football nerd listening to this podcast just nodded his head solemnly and stoically. And that, yes, you're right. That's the correct reaction to that. If you're a football
fan. Amateur historian such as ourselves.
Anyway, I mean, this guy's a right guard. And he's a Harvard-level actor. So this is very
It'd
strange.
Be nice if he did something with his
Mom's
life.
A cop. Yeah, but he's got, like, he's a everything threat. I mean, he's a threat everywhere. They literally make a movie about him called Love Story.
The Fugitive. Oh.
Somebody in his dorm room is like, wow, this is the most popular person in the history of the school. I'm going to write a movie about him.
Starting to hate him.
Yeah, Love Story, which is a huge hit in 1970. It's about the relationship between Tommy Lee Jones and his roommate, Al Gore.
When are you going to write a screenplay about me?
The dirty roommate of my brother's college dorm? I don't know.
We got to workshop that title.
Anyway, a screenwriter writes a movie about his relationship with Al Gore. Also, it's obviously a love story between McGraw. What's her name? Allie McGraw?
Sure.
Anyway, she was the hottest actress of her day from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, etc., etc. Huge hit at the time. Tommy Lee Jones actually plays the Al Gore role in the movie. Yeah. You know? Go figure. He gets out of college, and he's cast in Broadway pretty much immediately.
Here's Allie McGraw.
A Patriot for Me in 1969. Follows that up with Love Story in 1970. He returns to Broadway and acts on stage while he is a soap star in One Life to Live, where he pays the bills during the next 4 years as a soap opera star. He doesn't settle for the soaps, though. He really surges in his Broadway acting, which nets him quintessential Tommy Lee Jones-style roles in movies as an escaped convict, as a Vietnam War soldier, as a police detective. He earns his first Golden Globe nomination as fittingly, the husband of a country music star and the coal miner's daughter in 1980. Jones earned two Emmy nominations in the 80s after that as a murderer in The Executioner's Song, and then as a Texas Ranger in Lonesome Dove. I'm trying really hard not to do a Southern accent.
What a stretch that must have been.
Yeah. 1990.
I don't care! That might be my Tommy Lee Jones.
Oh, that's bad. 1990 ushers in The Fugitive, which for some reason I have a mental block on how to spell.
I don't care!
You don't like my shit on this one? Oh my god. He becomes a star and Academy Award winner in one fell swoop with 1990's Fugitive. It showcases his talents and leads into the sequel for that, U.S. Marshals, Men in Black. The sequels to Men in Black, of course. Cobb, which is an underrated performance. He's pretty great.
Yeah, I've never seen
as
that.
Ty Cobb. Yeah. Pretty racist, too. That movie's not going to be aired on cable TV anytime soon. Natural Born Killers. He is the warden, which is a terrifying movie just in general. Under Siege, he's fighting Steven Seagal. I didn't watch a lot of Steven Seagal movies.
I worked for a judge who was like a huge Seagal fan, so I had to pretend that I had seen a lot of them.
He's never. This is the most famous one.
I've never seen. Gary Busey.
I have my limits. Anyway, JFK, he earns his second Oscar nomination. Jones transitions his career, kind of like Alan Arkin in many ways. Like, overnight, he becomes an old man actor. Even, like, before he's old, an old man. But anyway, he, like, gets all the old man roles. Like, once he does one, like, oh, that's an old man.
There it is.
Anyway.
There's that accent.
Oh, darn it! Old man roles come his way. Fast and Furious. Space Cowboys. The Three Burials.
Wasn't in Fast and Furious.
What's that?
He wasn't in the Fast and Furious.
No.
He said,
sorry. I got to be careful when I'm listing off all these names. Movies. In the Valley of Elah, Hope Springs, and he starred as the old man in Mike's favorite movie, No Country for Old Men. 2012.
Just shaking my head.
Jones' latest Oscar nomination was for Thaddeus Stevens and his role in Lincoln. So I was 2 for 3. But I thought that Tommy Lee Jones was going to be the best one.
So Tommy Lee Jones is Thaddeus Stevens in Lincoln, debuting at the New York Film Festival on October 8th of 2012, a wide release November 9th of that same year, directed by Steven Spielberg, written by Tony Kushner, based on the book by Doris Kearns Goodwin. 12 Oscar nominations, as I said earlier. Only took home 2 wins, though. Nominated for Best Sound Mixing, Best Original Score, Best Costume Design. How do you not win Best Costume Design for a movie, a Spielberg Lincoln movie?
It's absurd, because there's only like 5 photos of Lincoln that you can find on the internet, right. And they look like this movie.
And it's Daniel Day-Lewis.
I mean, it's like, I was just like, I had goosebumps.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Maybe I'm a history nerd, yeah. Maybe that's my destiny, and I'm going to be showing Titanic to my students for the next 20 years.
But watch this!
Lincoln. But I tell you, I mean, this movie looked... historical. That's my take. Yeah.
Fresh out of the oven with a hot take. So Best Costume Design, it didn't win. Film Editing, Cinematography, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Director, Best Supporting Actress for Sally Field, Best Picture, and Tommy Lee Jones for Best Supporting Actor. Obviously, the 2 Oscars that it did take home were Best Production Design, which, sure.
Yes.
And Daniel Day-Lewis for... He's not Daniel Day-Lewis. So Abraham Lincoln for playing Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln is the star of this movie. I mean, this movie, look, I like football. I don't know if I've mentioned this before.
He's got this team.
I like it so much. I like it so much that in every winter, I like watch a million highlights for everybody that might remotely get drafted into the NFL. Watch college football highlights. And this movie, watching this movie for Tommy Lee Jones, felt like me watching the Alabama defense, looking at their backup strong safety to see if he's going to get drafted in the 6th round, and not like paying attention to Reuben Foster flying all over the field, cutting people in half, and Dalvin Tomlinson just driving the guard back into the quarterback's face every play. You can't take your eyes off of Daniel Day-Lewis in this movie, even though.
So
like
for those
I
of
said,
you keeping score at home, we're up to 2 football references
2
now
today and counting. But honestly, you can't take your eyes off of Daniel Day-Lewis in this movie.
I mean, it's silly.
That's why the first 3 scenes or 2.5 scenes with Tommy Lee Jones to establish that character there without President Lincoln in the fray. So I mentioned earlier, Alan Arkin proved the point. Like, this nomination is kind of for, you know, this kind of can be positioned as the Scene Stealer Award. Tommy Lee Jones, literally his first three scenes, he comes in at the end of the scene and then drops the mic.
Man, you like this, huh?
Yeah, I mean,
we're gonna have our first disagreement.
He literally comes and steals the scene with the last line, with the key line of those scenes. Good. Let's see.
But
you win. I'm sorry.
He's playing Tommy Lee Jones.
Right.
Like, he doesn't. If you're next to Daniel Day-Lewis in a movie where Daniel Day-Lewis is playing anybody, but especially a guy like Abe Lincoln, who's so universally known and historically relevant,
yep.
And you see Daniel Day-Lewis not as Daniel Day-Lewis at all, but as Abe Lincoln, and then you have Tommy Lee Jones, who's supposed to be Thaddeus Stevens, but like, he doesn't put an accent on, he doesn't change his look at all, he's just Tommy Lee Jones. Yeah, he's got good one-liners, I thought, but I didn't think he was a scene stealer. Not for me.
Well, I mean, he literally steals the scenes, Michael, at the end.
Well, you're wrong.
He's got one line in the scene, and he, like, turns his first scene that Tommy Lee Jones is in.
Right.
He is not in the scene for the until the last line,
right, when they're arguing,
he swivels his chair around, drops his line. Well, we don't know what the president's going to do. And everybody's just like, but, and you're just like, wow, that guy has authority, and he steals the seat.
Yeah, but I was just like, oh, there's Tommy Lee Jones.
And like, then they're at the Congress, and nobody talking, and then he just like...
The scene at the Congress,
takes
yes.
the mic away,
yes, the scene
takes
at the Congress,
the floor,
at
and it's like, in early well, on. You're a foppy-headed whatever, and just slams the guy.
So before we fist fight, if you've never seen the movie Lincoln, it's about the passage of the 13th Amendment, the abolition of slavery towards the end of the Civil War. Abe Lincoln's pretty much campaigning his ass off to fellow politicians, trying to get this amendment passed because he knows he needs to pass it before the end of the Civil War, which he knows is coming,
right.
Because the South is losing power. They need to agree to an ending of the war. Okay, that's the movie of Lincoln. Then the congressional battle that takes place that leads to the passage of the 13th. Again, not a spoiler. Take a history class. Now.
Right.
I didn't think Tommy Lee Jones, his character was integral to the plot. I thought
yes.
he was closer to
yes.
Alan Arkin than he was to, say, Philip Seymour Hoffman in terms of playing
his
a character.
The range of his performance.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you there. It's, you know, semantics.
No, we're going to
fight. If you want to talk about scene stealing or not scene stealing.
I want to headbutt you!
Mike likes wrestling. He just gave me his best impression of Gorilla Monsoon from the 1980s.
Mike turns around. I'm going to hit him with a steel chair.
It wouldn't last very long. I mean, listen, you know, Tommy Lee Jones as a plot device works perfectly. And I was really impressed with the screenwriting in that regard, because you have to build...
I will agree with that.
You have to build him up as the rival that Lincoln turns into an ally. And that's like that beginning of the second act. Give, you know, Lincoln's movement towards really pressing this 13th Amendment, pressing his main objective into a possibility, because it's up against everybody's naysaying up to that point. And once he gets Tommy Lee Jones on his team, and that's my favorite scene in the movie right there, I think because I was focused on it perhaps, even though I would say the end to Congress is pretty great, that sequence. My favorite scene of the movie is when Tommy Lee Jones and Lincoln meet in the kitchens, and Tommy Lee Jones gives that great, powerful, what we would call that bleeding heart speech, where he just knows what's right. And he's not going to compromise. And he just states it to Lincoln, everything that he believes. And then Lincoln just calmly tells him the folktale of, well, what about those travelers that knew true north? They knew how to follow their compass, but they died of dysentery on the way. They got eaten by wolves. What good is it to know true north, my friends? I'm, you know, botching that speech.
That wasn't a bad Lincoln impression.
But, I mean, I tell you what. I mean, he absolutely... just by telling anecdotes, and which is, if you read anything about Lincoln, was his persona.
Which they hit on in the movie brilliantly.
That is so hard to do as a writer, to have every scene branch off into an anecdote, still feel dramatic and tense, not, you know, lose its track and bring it
home.
But
isn't that a credit to Daniel Day-Lewis, not Tommy Lee Jones?
Yes.
Okay. So when you're talking about the relevance of a supporting actor...
My essential point was, as a plot device, the Tommy Lee Jones character worked, and that scene just worked so well for me.
But again, doesn't that have more to do with the screenwriting than it does the acting? Mm-hmm. Like, when you're talking about a supporting character, what makes a supporting character for you personally? I'm asking your opinion. Is it the writing, or is it the way the actor pulls it off?
In my opinion, the writing...
So you're more screenwriting, because you are a writer.
The writing nominated two of these five characters. And I would say Philip Seymour Hoffman, and we'll get into the rest. I mean, for me, Tommy Lee Jones is Tommy Lee Jones in this movie.
He's me too. That's
he's a great actor. I loved him.
He is a great actor. I wanted more.
I know, but he's getting nominated for basically just having punchlines and, you know, raising his voice a few times.
What's the difference between his nomination and Alan Arkin's nomination?
That's my point.
We just said Alan Arkin shouldn't have been nominated.
Tommy Lee Jones should not have been nominated either.
Well, so you're on my side here.
Yeah, wait, what the
hell? I thought you were defending him.
No.
Oh. All right, fuck Tommy Lee Jones.
We agreed again by accident.
I thought you were defending him.
No.
Oh, all right. Well, I'm an idiot then. I can't understand English.
I started off the whole conversation saying he's not Reuben Foster. How did you not pick up my signals? Didn't you watch Alabama last night?
You know what? You're right. That's on me. That's my fault. No, I thought you were defending him. I thought you were saying that he was... I mean, his character obviously is an integral part to the whole story. He is given importance, but he's Tommy Lee Jones.
It's like watching the Michigan State's running back and not staring at their left tackle.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Blocking
it's,
in front of him
yeah,
2 years
it's,
ago.
Daniel Day-Lewis overpowers this movie.
I am in awe of his filmography. I mean, if you think about his character in Gangs of New York... And then contrast him with his character in Lincoln, and contrast that with his character in My Left Foot.
They're different people.
And then again with There Will Be Blood.
Of course his wife loves him. She gets to live with different people she basically cheats on her husband. Because he's one of those method actors that has to be in character the whole time. But goddamn does it pay off.
I mean, we really should put bets in Vegas on his role in the Paul Thomas Anderson movie.
Him being retired is the biggest... I mean, yeah, I would retire too if I could... pick any job I wanted and know I'm going to get an Oscar for it.
My God.
You know, I mean, yes. I thought we were fighting. I thought you were... My interpretation was you were defending Tommy Lee Jones, and I just didn't... I guess, like you, I don't see how he was anything but Agent J in this movie.
He was fine. He was good, and I just think he, like you said, as a plot device... As I said, a plot device, as you said, as a presence in terms... They needed star power to go against Daniel Day-Lewis. They don't have to have anybody, you know, going off and doing the Bryan Cranston thing from Argo. But you need somebody with that presence.
But to see what a guy like Jones is capable, and this is a big admission for me, but to see what a guy like Jones is capable of in No Country for Old Men, and then to have this performance, I don't think there's any comparison.
No.
And I hated No Country for Old Men, which has been well documented. But it's a good performance, and this is just Tommy Lee Jones in a wig.
Tommy Lee Jones in a bald wing, saying wonderful things.
Yeah.
Having the punchlines of his first three scenes. His first three scenes, he's dunking on people. And then he obviously plays, you know, one of the better hair-raising moments in the movie where he joins forces with the other great person in the movie.
It's like Hulk Hogan and the Macho Man.
Yeah,
I totally
feel
agree.
Great about it. And it's like...
the mega powers.
That's what we voted in. Like, we voted in the character, the screenplay, we voted in... Are we really voting in Tommy Lee Jones? Like, there's so many more Tommy Lee Jones performances out there that are way better than this one.
Totally agree. And there's so many more Oscars you could have given this movie if you wanted to decorate it.
Yeah.
Including costume design.
Right. I just want to say something about the cast. Like,
no, I'm sorry. We have no time. Moving on.
Everybody in the next... Like, everybody who's going to matter for the next 10 years in a male role is in this movie. Right? This movie is like the Skull and Bones, the Ivy League secret society for the next 15 years.
Okay,
Joseph
go ahead.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Adam Driver, you know, anyway, the guys in the beginning of the movie.
David Stratham.
Well, David Stratham's kind of already established. I'm talking young actors. You watch the young actors in this movie. The kid from Valerian was in this movie.
I didn't even notice him.
There are so many young actors who wanted to work with Steven Spielberg, who have a recognizable face. I mean, this was like the Black Hawk Down of you know, you watch Black Hawk Down now, you're like, oh, that's him. Right. That's him. Mm-hmm. These are the next 20 years of, you know, British people acting like Americans.
I may have missed it because there's
a lot of big American actors.
You can tell how critically I watched.
It's hard to watch anybody but Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, no, and even the first 5 minutes of the film, it's totally exposition. It's Daniel Day-Lewis being like, oh, I'm Abe Lincoln, and remember when I did the Emancipation Proclamation? Here's what I said, 4 score. Like, I know, but it's so captivating.
The moments where he kind of is self-referential. Spielberg, I'm talking about more than anything. The moments where he kind of tries to get cute with the history are the moments that he probably loses the awards in this movie.
Yeah, I mean...
in general about this movie, like, where, you know, you love the Sally Field, Mrs. Lincoln versus Abraham Lincoln arguments. I mean, those are electric. I mean,
yeah, those are arguments. Sally Field doesn't want their son to go to war. The son feels like he has to go to war. The son is Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and Abraham Lincoln's trying to support him because he knows what the feeling is.
But when she has to, you know, mention like all the stereotypes about her real life, you know, history book, you know, synopsis, he's taken out of the movie. Yeah. You're like, oh God, why do you got to mention that? Just show her.
Clearly, just read a Wikipedia page.
She's like, well, everybody thinks I'm crazy, but I'm really this.
Yeah, the exposition is tough. But that said, I mean, the point I was going for with the first 5 minutes where he was recapping the Emancipation Proclamation and all that, I mean...
Right, it's too cute.
It is. It's boring, but it's still captivating. It's still like, holy shit, this is Abraham Lincoln telling me this. This isn't just a guy. You know what I mean? Like, it's boring, and it has to be done. But at the same time, you're like, God damn, Daniel Day-Lewis is way better at acting than I am at breathing.
Right. he becomes this person. Like, it's just effortless. I don't know what he does, what his process is, his method acting. I mean, he
probably kills hobos. That's right.
He probably lives as that role. I mean, he's tall. He's got the weird skinny build. I mean, I just can't get over how convincing he was. Like I said, I mean, you look at the few pictures available of Abraham Lincoln, and tell me that didn't nail it. Yeah, they didn't nail it. Tell me they didn't nail it. So, best scenes for you, Mike?
Best scene for me, as far as the ones Jones was in. It was where Thaddeus Stevens meets with the Democratic representative and tells him to support the bills that needs bipartisan support, and then after the election he can switch parties. And he's basically telling this guy what his political future is going to be. And those are the scenes Tommy Lee Jones shines in.
Muscle
flex. They're
funny,
they're quick, yeah, and you know, they're Crips. They're not best supporting actor worthy, but that was my favorite scene, at least as far as Thaddeus Stevens was concerned.
I have my favorite Tommy Lee Jones scene, but my favorite scene overall is when Lincoln's about to tell his, you know, military commander another story, and the guy literally goes off on him. He's like, wait, you're going to tell another story? I can't believe you're going to tell another story. I'm walking out, not listening to this. And then, of course, the room just like lets him leave, lets him walk, fume off. And then Lincoln tells another awesome story. And
they come back to it, and everybody's looking at Lincoln, like, captivated exactly. on his every word.
That's great. That was funny. A great scene.
Least favorite. Or do you have a favorite particular to Jones?
The epilogue wasn't great, but also, like I said, the prologue and epilogue were just, it got too cute for me.
I hated it.
And it was very anticlimactic in terms of the epilogue. I mean, I understand that he's trying to be graceful with it. I think you either got to go soaringly epic or you got to be artful. But it's like he wasn't trying to do either.
I hated the
prologue and epilogue. I was just
hated it. I thought the assassination had nothing to do with this movie, nothing to do with the plot. I feel like he just stuffed it in because that's what everyone thinks of when they think of Lincoln right off the top. You know, it was either abolition of slavery. He was shot dead in a theater by John Wilkes Booth.
Yeah, I mean,
it wasn't necessary.
It's like you have a great movie and then the rat climbs over the Capitol building at the end of The Departed. I almost hated that movie because of that one shot. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah,
what are you doing? Yeah. It's a, this is in the middle here is a masterpiece.
Yeah, you make a great point. He really directed himself out of a statue.
We got a great script. Great script. I was shocked. I mean, I literally went through, you know, like 20-minute periods where I didn't take a note. I was just captivated and hooked. Maybe, you know, 5 years ago, I was, you know, not as old and, you know, beard stroking as I am today. I wasn't as big of a nerd, and I didn't like this movie as much, but I don't know. I mean, I've read a lot of nonfiction since then. I've watched a lot of documentaries.
Done a ton of cocaine.
I've drinked a lot of Pilsners. Anyway, I ate this movie up. So if you haven't seen Lincoln in a while, and you're older and wiser, and you...
So this is a not watch, don't watch for
this
you.
This is a watch. Man.
Oh, okay.
This is a watch. Yes, I was shocked at how into this movie I was.
I can't say the same for myself because I'm not as big a history buff, but it's a watch solely on the fact that you have to see Daniel Day-Lewis.
You have to see him.
Yeah, I think we've covered that.
One of the best performances ever.
Episode 10, Dead and Buried, in the ground, in the books, in the record department, in your town hall. I'm going to stretch this analogy out till it loses all particular meaning. Where else do you put things? A shelf? Closet? The attic? Anyway, that's it. Episode 10, done. 2012 Best Supporting Actor. Did the first part, all set. We're going to finish up, like I said, at the beginning of this episode. The second part, probably going to drop either Wednesday or Thursday of this week. I'm not saying I promise, because I'm out of that business. We've already broken, like, 37 promises. Don't worry about that. So, just look for it, you know? It's going to be out later this week at some point. We're going to, like I said, finish up with the 2012 Best Supporting Actor category. We're going to give you the profiles on Christoph Waltz, who won the category for his work in Django. We're going to give you Robert De Niro for his work in Silver Linings Playbook. Big comeback performance for old Bobby Movies there. And then we're going to give you Perfecting Perfection. We're going to re-rank the 2012 Supporting Actor category, both with the nominees and the overall for the year, and pick what should have been nominated, what should have won, and what shouldn't have. And I'm way too popular, so I have to turn off my phone right now so you don't hear it anymore. But that's it. You know, if you haven't checked us out, if you weren't with us over Thanksgiving break, you were too tied up in your kitchen or with family, we understand. We hope you had a good time. Be sure to check out our backlog on SoundCloud, Mike, and Oscar on SoundCloud. We got our Netflix year in review in there. Mike and I went over 30-plus Netflix original movies to tell you which ones are worth your time and which ones aren't. You're going to want to be sure to check that out. Also, our previous episode before that was our bunch of hot takes. We talk about, it's our Hollywood hot takes episode. Every once in a while, we're going to drop a news episode on you guys, give you our opinions on what's going on in the world of Hollywood, the big movie stories of the day. Obviously, we talk a lot about the Louis C.K., Harvey Weinstein, all that terrible sexual assault and sexual harassment stuff going on that's pervading Hollywood right now. And we give you a lot of other news and insights and our views on what's happening in the world of movies and the Academy at this very moment. But as for this episode, as for this time between yourselves and me right here at this microphone speaking to you, it's at an end. And no one's sadder than I am. But we'll be back soon. Have no fear. We will be back later this week. We'll give you the second part of the 2012 Best Supporting Actor category. Stay tuned for that. And until then, always remember, guys, reality sucks. Watch movies with us. Hit us up, send us an email or a comment, keep on listening, and we'll get to you soon. Later.